Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon, or good morning, depending on where you are joining us from. Today's webinar is on the subject of ISO 45001:2018, where we provide an overview of the standard. I'm going to wait another moment in case there's anyone joining at the last minute, and then we will go ahead and get started. My name is Austin Matthews. I am the EHS Program Manager with PJR. Welcome. I have a brief agenda on this first slide. We will be talking about, as I said, ISO 45001, an overview of the standard. We'll begin with a little bit about Perry Johnson Registrars, who we are and what we do. We'll cover some of the benefits of certification to a standard like ISO 45001. We will cover the key requirements of the standard, as well as go through an overview of some of the key clauses of the standard. There are a couple other related requirements that go hand in hand with ISO 45001 certification I will touch on as well. And for anyone who is considering initial certification to ISO 45001, I will provide a summary of that certification process as well. Benefits and drivers for certification vary by standard, by industry, by company, by location. There's so many variables. However, there are a couple common themes that we can discuss here on this slide. Certainly, the standard being an occupational health and safety standard drives improvement in an organization's occupational health and safety performance by maintaining and implementing the requirements of the standard. You are working to provide a safe environment in which to do business. Implementing and maintaining the requirements of the standard can also minimize the risk of production delays, drives improvement in areas such as management commitment and employee engagement levels, assists or provides a framework for meeting legal requirements that the organization may be subject to. There are benefits as far as strategic business management goes as well, including the ability to meet stakeholder requirements, improve an organization's public image, as well as providing a competitive advantage over competitors or other organizations that may not hold certifications such as ISO 45001. The standard can be integrated with other business management systems and standards. There can be improvements to supplier health and safety performance as well, so not only affecting the organization, but potentially its suppliers as well. And there can be other financial benefits not listed here. In some areas, there could be cost savings associated with insurance premiums for maintaining a voluntary occupational health and safety standard certification like ISO 45001. Just to provide a very brief overview of the standard, ISO 45001:2018 replaced its predecessor, OSAS 18001:2007. The standard defines requirements for establishing, implementing, and maintaining an occupational health and safety management system, which is abbreviated to OHSMS. Standard represents a framework that allows an organization to control its hazards, reduce the risk of accidents, injuries, ill health, and/or downtime, as well as to continually improve its processes and operations. The standard was published in March 2018, and it is a voluntary certification, meaning that it is not a regulatory requirement that an organization maintain this certification. Like other ISO standards, ISO 45001 includes and adopts the Annex SL structure, which provides a common format and very similar terminology for greater integration ability and ease of use across the various ISO standards. I've included a snapshot of the Plan, Do, Check, Act model as is found in ISO 45001. Some of the key requirements of the standard, just at a high level before we begin to review some of the clauses themselves. As I mentioned, that adoption of the Annex SL structure. The standard emphasizes leadership. There is a clause specifically assigning responsibility to those in leadership roles to be promoting the health and safety management system within the organization, to really set that example, set the tone, communicate its importance, allocate resources as needed for the system to be successful and work effectively. So that is emphasized in the standard. There is also a call for proactivity in several locations in the standard to ensure that organizations are planning ahead, incorporating the management system into their decision-making process to account for potential hazards and risks and incidents, rather than making changes and then reacting to the impact it has on the organization, whether that be the employees or in other ways. There's also a focus on risk management, and these two go hand in hand to plan and determine the impact of potential issues or changes. The intended outcomes are defined within the standard. There's an emphasis on objectives, measurement, and change. There are expectations for the organization, to improve the health and safety performance of the organization rather than simply finding ways to improve the management system itself. The standard gives equal emphasis to external and internal communications, and it separates requirements for awareness and competency, and it specifically prescribes criteria for awareness levels. The term documented information is incorporated into ISO 45001, that is part of the Annex SL structure. This term is used to reflect a wide variety of options for recording an organization's information and give flexibility as to what an organization may determine requires a procedure, or how else they could effectively control their processes. The strategic planning processes stress the importance of an occupational health and safety management system. And going hand in hand with a expectation of proactivity, there is a expectation for management of change to ensure, as changes are being planned, we are again being proactive rather than reactive. I've included some of the terms in these slides. As I mentioned, the slides will be available on PJR's website sometime after the webinar ends. They are also found within the standard itself, so feel free to refer to those. I won't be reading through them today, but I have included them for reference. The only thing I'd like to point out is on this first slide, within the definition of the Occupational Health and Safety Management System is a note regarding the intended outcomes. I mentioned intended outcomes just a couple of slides ago. So here we find a definition for that. The intended outcomes of the management system are to prevent injury and ill health to workers and to provide safe and healthy workplaces. So some of the verbiage in the standard and some of the measurements of effectiveness will be in regards to the organization's ability to meet its intended outcomes rather than previous methods of measuring improvement or effectiveness of the management system. Are the intended outcomes of the management system being achieved? Is how ISO 45001 expects organizations to measure their effectiveness. Okay, so the next part of the webinar will go through some, not all, of the clauses found within the standard, so you can get familiar with the layout of the standard and where some of those key requirements can be found. Clause 4 covers the context of the organization, which is another definition or term that you can find defined in the standard itself. The internal and external issues relevant to the management system and their ability to achieve intended outcomes is part of the beginning or initial section of 4.1, understanding the organization and its context. We need to understand and have determined what those issues are, and then we build on that as we progress. 4.2 covers understanding the needs and expectations of workers and other interested parties. Again, a stepping stone or part of the framework here is to determine which interested parties are relevant to the organization. We're not just talking about workers when we say interested parties. And then once the interested parties have been determined, we also determine their needs and expectations, which often translate to requirements of the management system. An interested party may not have any needs or expectations, but if they do, they need to be identified. How do you know whether you or your organization are meeting the needs and expectations of those interested parties if they haven't been identified? 4.3 covers determination of the scope, the management system itself. So again, I mentioned these are building blocks. We're going to consider the issues, the internal and external issues we identified in 4.1, as well as the needs and expectations we identified in 4.2 to be able to determine an occupational health and safety scope. Clause 5 covers leadership and worker participation. 5.1 is focused solely on leadership and commitment. Top management, which is underlined because it's also a defined term, should, among other things, take on more responsibility for the effectiveness of the management system, the integration of the management system into business processes, the adequacy of resources, and the communication of the need to conform to the Occupational Health and Safety Management System. The policy requirements are found in Clause 5.2. The policy and objectives should be aligned with the organization's strategic direction, and achieve the system's intended outcomes. Avoiding incidents, injuries, ill health, providing a safe environment in which to do business. The occupational health and safety policy needs to include a commitment to participation, among other things. All of the criteria for the policy can be found in 5.2. Focuses on the organization's roles or authorities. A management representative is not explicitly mentioned. It's up to top management to ensure that authorities are assigned, adequate responsibilities are allocated. These responsibilities can be delegated by top management, but top management is still ultimately accountable for the effectiveness of the occupational health and safety management system. Clause 5.4 covers participation and consultation of workers, both of which are defined in the standard. These requirements are prescriptive and specific. You can refer to Clause 5.4 to understand everything that the process needs to take into account or identify. Things like identifying training methods and resources, identifying and removing or minimizing if removal is not possible, any obstacles keeping employees from participating, such as a fear of reprisal or language barrier, as well as emphasizing non-manager participation and consultation. Clause 6.1 covers actions to address risk and opportunities. The risks and opportunities need to be determined in order to ensure the management system can achieve its intended outcomes and prevent or minimize those undesired effects, as well as to continually improve. Risks and opportunities can be determined related to occupational health and safety hazards, legal and other requirements, and or risks and opportunities that could affect the organization's achievement of its intended outcomes. Hazard identification is specifically addressed in Clause 6.1.2.1, and this section is again prescriptive and proactive in nature. There are a variety of things to consider here. Again, we don't want to focus solely on the employees. There could be people in the nearby area who can be affected by the organization or its activities. There could be people at the workplace who are not controlled by the organization but could still be affected. We could think in terms of the work area, the equipment design. Here we see a nod to the change management or the proactive expectations for proposed changes that could affect the occupational health and safety management system. We can draw on learnings from past incidents and so on. The organization needs to have a process to assess occupational health and safety risks, and documented information needs to be retained as evidence. Similarly, there's to be a process to assess occupational health and safety opportunities as relevant to the organization's occupational health and safety performance. 6.1.3 requires the organization to determine legal and other requirements to which they are subject. These need to be maintained as an up-to-date determination of applicable requirements, and access to them needs to be maintained as well. Not only do we want to identify those applicable requirements, we also need to determine how the requirements apply to the organization, as well as to the organization's hazards and risks. What do those requirements mean the organization has to do? How do they need to ensure compliance? What is required of them? How do they measure that? Do they need to submit anything, monitor anything, label things a certain way, verify things at a certain frequency? What are the requirements? How do they affect the organization? Are there any associated communication requirements with those legal and other requirements, such as reporting of changes, submission of reports at a certain frequency, things like that? These need to be considered in the maintenance and improvement of the management system as well. 6.1.4 focuses on the planning of action, and this needs to address risks, opportunities, legal and other requirements, emergency situations, integration into the management system, and evaluation of effectiveness. We want to make sure we're taking into account the hierarchy of controls, which is found in section 8.1.2. Objectives are covered in clause 6.2. The actual identification of objectives and what they need to take into consideration is found in 6.2.1. Planning how to achieve the objectives is covered in 6.2.2, and the organization is specifically required to determine and maintain documented information as evidence of what tasks are used to achieve the objectives, what resource needs they require, who's responsible, what is the timeline, and all of these other criteria. Jumping ahead a bit, 7.2 covers competence requirements, and 7.3 similarly covers awareness requirements. The organization gets to determine the competency requirements for workers that can affect the performance of the occupational health and safety management system. And the organization needs to maintain documented information as evidence of meeting those competency requirements. If any action needs to be taken to meet the competency requirements, those actions need to be evaluated for effectiveness. So, for example, if training is provided to close a competency gap, an evaluation of effectiveness could, for example, include a test or observation of the employee conducting the activity they were just trained to do. Those are just some quick examples. Certainly not the only ways of meeting those requirements by any means. The awareness clause identifies specific items that workers must be made aware of by the organization, including the real or potential ramifications of deviating from the management system requirements. Certainly, an organization can add to the awareness requirements, but you do want to make sure that at least everything introduced in 7.3 is incorporated into the process. External communication is covered in 7.4.3. The organization needs to determine what information needs to be communicated and how. Think back to those external interested parties and consider those where relevant. 7.5 covers documented information. This identifies specific controls that need to be identified by the organization in regards to creating, updating, and controlling that defined documented information term. Clause 8 focuses on operation, and there are a number of subclauses here covering a wide variety of items. 8.1.1 is a general subclause. It indicates that planned actions must have established process criteria with sufficient documented information maintained to ensure the process criteria were met. The hierarchy of controls, as I mentioned, can be found in 8.1.2, and that is used in the elimination or reduction of hazards and risks. Management of change is found in 8.1.3. and this requires the implementation of a process to control planned changes that could affect the occupational health and safety performance of the organization. This review is intended to help mitigate any negative impacts of changes made. Some examples to consider might be introducing new products, services, or processes to the organization, changing working conditions, changing equipment, changes to applicable legal and other requirements, and so on. Procurement is covered in 8.1.4 to ensure that outsourced processes are controlled to the extent that they are able to affect the occupational health and safety management system or the organization's occupational health and safety performance. Contractors are covered in 8.1.4.2 to identify and control any risks related to the activities of contractors. This could be the contractor's activities impacting the organization and or its workers, or the reverse, the organization and or its workers impacting contractors and their activities. The section also requires that contractor selection criteria be identified and a process in place to ensure contractor activities meet those requirements. Outsourcing is addressed in 8.1.4.3 to identify controls to ensure that procured material and or services also meet the occupational health and safety management system requirements and don't prevent the organization from meeting its intended outcomes. Emergency preparedness and response is covered in 8.2. There are a number of items required to be included in the emergency response plan or process, so do refer to 8.2 to ensure your process addresses each of those items. Clause 9.1 covers the monitoring, measurement, analysis, and performance evaluation requirements. 9.1.1 is general in nature and discusses that the organization needs to determine the relevant monitoring and measurement requirements, not just what will be monitored, but how and so on, to ensure the effectiveness of the management system and to evaluate the occupational health and safety performance. The requirements for the internal audits are outlined in 9.2 with some specific subclauses found within, for example, 9.2.2, which requires that the organization maintain an internal audit program that identifies specific factors to be determined within the audit plan or program, and also requires the results be reported to relevant managers, workers, and or representatives, and any other relevant interested parties. So those outputs from the internal audit are to be shared. 9.3 addresses management review. There are requirements as to what needs to be included in the inputs and outputs of a management system review, which is to be performed by top management. So in order to ensure that your management review covers all of the required criteria, do refer to 9.3. Clause 10 focuses on improvement. 10.1 is the general subclause and includes a requirement for identifying opportunities for improvement. Again, this goes hand in hand with the expectations for proactive approaches. 10.2 covers incident, nonconformity, and corrective actions. It requires timely action to address or correct any incidents and nonconformities. It requires that corrective actions be reviewed for effectiveness and have documented information as evidence. It also requires, again, that the results be reported to relevant workers and or representatives and any other relevant interested parties. 10.3 covers continual improvement. It requires the occupational health and safety management system be continually improved in a number of ways. The standard also includes an annex with guidance on the use of the document, as well as a bibliography, neither of which we will be going through today. When the ISO 45001 standard was published, there were a few other related documents published in a similar timeframe that impact our ISO 45001 clients. So these IAF mandatory documents, as they do affect our ISO 45001 clients, I like to present some of that information in this webinar as well. So just as ISO 45001 raised the bar for clients in comparison to its predecessor, OSAS 18001, 2007, these IAF mandatory documents do raise the bar as well. It requires that organizations notify their certification body of significant changes as soon as possible when they occur, rather than waiting until the next audit, as some of those significant changes can very much impact the planning of an organization's audit. There is a prescribed audit timetable required by these IAF mandatory documents, where audit time is calculated based on risk level and employee count. It is not something that a certification body creates on their own and should vary widely from CB to CB, since it is prescribed. There's a requirement in the IAF mandatory documents referenced on this slide that top management is really supposed to be part of the closing meeting. They're supposed to be involved in the audit. Think back to those leadership requirements that we discussed as far as what top management is ultimately accountable for. It makes sense that they should be involved in the audits, be aware of how the system is running and how the audit is going. So within these documents, there is a requirement that if top management does not attend the closing meeting of the audit, an excuse for their absence needs to be provided and documented by the auditor. And it needs to be a reasonable excuse to avoid a nonconformity against the leadership clause. Otherwise, these annual or semi-annual audits, depending on your contract, should be a significant enough concept for the integrity and effectiveness of the management system to warrant scheduling around the audits, to make yourself available for them, or to join remotely if you can't be there in person, to again maintain that evidence of leadership accountability. Personnel responsible for monitoring employee health, such as doctors or nurses, are required to be available for interview during audits. This does not apply to all organizations, but if it applies to the organization, it is supposed to be part of the audit sampling. A certification body may conduct special audits in response to compliance issues, incidents, and so on, and may even suspend or withdraw certification depending on the nature of the compliance issues. Any legal compliance violations or gaps may prevent or impede initial certification, and objective evidence will be required to assess this further. Those are some of the key requirements in the IAF mandatory documents that I feel giving clients a heads up about or sharing with clients in advance can be helpful. Okay, so these last couple of slides contain an overview of the certification process for anyone who is considering initial certification to ISO 45001. And then we will close with any questions that you might have. The first step whenever you are pursuing initial certification to a standard is to get a copy of that standard. You'll need to establish occupational health and safety management system documentation to meet the ISO 45001 requirements. You'll conduct training to occupational health and safety management system requirements, implement the requirements of the management system and standard, including conducting an internal audit, a compliance evaluation, and a management system review. The outputs of the internal audit are required to be inputs for the management review. You'll also need a contract with a certification body, such as Perry Johnson Registrars, to conduct your audits. You'll complete stage one and stage two audits for initial certification, address any resulting nonconformities before a certificate can be issued. Specifically, stage one audits are typically a documentation review to assess the adequacy of the framework, the organization's framework, and whether or not it meets the standard requirements. Overall, the goal of the stage one is to assess the readiness of the organization for their stage two audit. The stage two audit, on the other hand, is a full system audit of the entire management system. It assesses the implementation of the documented information that was reviewed at stage one and confirms whether or not the system is effectively meeting the requirements of the standard. Again, any nonconformities identified during stage two do need to be resolved before a certificate can be issued. But once that certificate is issued, it is good for 3 years and you enter the next 2 years of the cycle, which are the surveillance audits. Depending on your contract, you could have annual or semi-annual audits, and those are partial system audits, not as long or as wide as the stage two audit would be. The third year of the audit cycle is a recertification audit, which, very similar to a stage two audit, is a full system audit and results in the issuance of another certificate to restart the cycle anew. With ISO 45001, we do also sometimes see integrated audits. If you have more than one management system or pursue or maintain certification to other standards that can be integrated, if the audits and the management system are both integrated, audit time can be discounted. We do our best to verify the integration eligibility prior to the audit, but that discount is subject to be removed if the management system is found not to be integrated after all. So that is possible. Some of you may have recognized some of the standards listed on one of my first slides. We commonly see integration of standards such as ISO 14001 with ISO 45001. So you're getting the environmental and the occupational health and safety aspects covered for an EHS system. So that may be something that you think about, whether that applies to you or not. You can discuss that further with your salesperson or scheduler. And I will actually share contact information for the sales department if you are a prospective client looking for a quote. Let me get to that slide. So if you have any questions and you haven't typed them already, please go ahead and do so. I will review those now. And while I do that, I'm going to put some contact information up on this last slide. Again, my name is Austin Matthews. I am the EHS Program Manager with PJR. I can be contacted via email or through the main PJR number. They can put you through to my extension. I've also included a phone number for the sales department in case you would like to get the ball rolling and receive a quote for initial certification through ISO 45001. They would be happy to help. Let's see what questions we may have. And feel free to keep typing if you are working on submitting a question as well. Thank you very much for the feedback. I appreciate that. No questions so far, but I will hang out to see if anyone is typing. Otherwise, thank you for joining us today. Again, a recording of the webinar will be made available on PJR's website, as well as a copy of the slides for your reference. We also have a number of other great webinars that PJR offers, so feel free to check out the subjects of other webinars coming up. We have one question here about compliance audits. The question says, is there any time frame for compliance audit? I'm not sure whether you mean duration of the compliance audit or when the compliance audit should be completed. If it's the latter, we would want to see the compliance audit completed prior to your audit with PJR so that we would be able to sample those records. If you're talking about duration, oh, I see your second message, sorry, duration. No, not specifically. The standard doesn't specify. That is one area that the organization can determine based on a number of factors. I would certainly think in regards to the number of applicable legal and other requirements and how long it would take to effectively review those. I think that would vary by organization, the size of the organization, the industry, and how many requirements you're subject to. It's also up to the organization to determine who would be competent to conduct those compliance evaluations. There may be some guidance in Annex A of the standard, as well as some of the other ISO documentation to ensure that they are familiar enough with the industry and the legal and other requirements to which you're subject to effectively review them, but that is up to the organization to decide. I hope that helps. Thank you for your questions. You're welcome. So far, I still don't see any other questions, so that may be it for today. Feel free to hop off and join us again in the future for another webinar. I'll wait another moment and see if any other questions pop up. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon, everyone. Okay, I don't see any additional questions, so I'm going to sign off for today. Thank you again for joining me, and I hope to see you again at another webinar soon.